The Monocle Quality of Life Conference returns, and this time we're touching down in Zurich. Join Monocle's editors and a lineup of tack-sharp panelists for lively debate, informed conversation, and top-notch hospitality from the 28th to the 30th of June. Find out more and book your ticket now at conference.monocle.com. This week we speak to the creative director of iconic men's title, Fantastic Man. Launched in 2005, it remains one of the most influential fashion titles on newsstands. Plus, you're in for a treat if you also enjoy watches and timekeeping. And we head out of our studios to an exhibition all about the unique power of independent print. That's all ahead today on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis with me, Tom Edwards. Coming up today, a new exhibition at Somerset House here in London about the power of independent titles and how they've changed the world. And we browse the print Bible for those who love their watches. But we start the show with a truly iconic title, the much-loved men's magazine, Fantastic Man. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to the magazine's creative director, and himself a friend of Monocle's, Jop van Bennekom. And Fernando's here to tell us about his chat with Jop. Before we hear from one of those fantastic men himself, Faye, always good, isn't it, to check up with them? Definitely one of our favourite titles here on The Stack.
Absolutely. Anton, do you believe that Fantastic Man's on the newsstand since 2005? I mean, there's more than a decade and they remain influential. And it was interesting chatting with Jop. I mean, the last issue, which I have one issue here in hand, they have 8 different covers, but as Jop was saying in the interview that you're going to hear very soon, they make sense every single cover. They were talking about age and man. So for example, here on the cover there's a guy called, he's 78 years old, his name is Stephen, and they're just models, they're just random models, they're a young boy of 14. He just talk about men and age. There's a lovely photo shoot here about men in their middle age as well. Fantastic Man has been launched, there's been so many new, you know, menswear titles on the newsstand, you know, even in our local one at Chewton Street, there's like 2 kind of lines of full of men's magazines. But I have to say, only the good ones will last in a way. And it's funny that you mentioned that, because there's another very iconic menswear title that will be back on the newsstands next week, actually. L'Uomo Vogue, last year they announced that there'll be a closure, you know, they're cutting some titles, but it will be back as a biannual title. Very happy news indeed. I think L'Uomo Vogue together, Fantastic Man, they represent those amazing, you know, menswear publications for all ages.
Indeed, superstars of the newsstand. Let's dip in then. Let's hear from Jop van Bennekom, of course, creative director of Fantastic Man. He was talking to Fernando a little earlier.
Well, I think we're already in our 12th year now, so we've gone through many changes. So the magazine keeps on changing with every issue, and maybe those changes are not so big when you just see them from issue to issue, but they're actually quite big when you look at an issue from 5 years ago and from now. But recently we have had more, maybe bigger shifts where we are experimenting a little bit with themes and with different ways of approaching manhood and men's fashion.
Talking about themes, I mean, that's, the, you know, you have, I believe, about 8 different covers, right?
Yes.
I have one cover here from Stephen. He's 78 years old. So is that one of the themes you wanted to talk about, age, you know, because you also have other covers with very young men as well.
Yeah, so we have 8 different covers with 4 men in older age, like set between 70 and 80. And we have 4 covers with young teenagers, like 14, 15. One of 18, actually, or 17, I think. But basically, men and boys normally don't get to the cover of a magazine at that age. So in a way, it's also like a kind of an anti-cover, or they're normal, ordinary people. By juxtaposing young and old, we just try to talk about age in different generations of men, which is the theme of this issue.
And in terms of production, is it the first time you're doing different covers as well? Is it a bit more complicated, you know, when you go to the printer or not? Or it was a good challenge for you?
No, it was actually not so difficult to do print-wise, and also not so expensive. It's more that we, I think, for a long time we wanted to be that one magazine who didn't do multiple covers, because there's so many other magazines in our field of biannual publications that actually are doing so many different covers that you don't hardly know which issue you're looking at anymore, which I think is kind of problematic at the newsstand. So we always wanted to be that one magazine that just does one cover. But I had this idea of doing a story that plays out visually on the newsstand, and they're like images that are actually linked to each other. They're part of the same photo shoot. And I thought that was a nice experiment to do. So it doesn't have anything to do with also giving into that sort of demand of doing multiple covers and trying to create something almost Instagram-like. It was more about doing this experiment and creating also a bit of excitement around the magazine and the cover. I think that really works, yeah.
No, it did work. And you, as you mentioned, you know, there are eight covers, but they are very much Fantastic Man. And they tell a story, all the eight covers together in a
yes,
way.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
You mentioned Instagram there. I mean, of course, the magazine, of course, is the main product. What's your relationship with online, also as the creative director of the magazine?
Well, it's just also ever-changing. I think a lot of magazines and a lot of, I think, brands and institutions, they don't feel so much at home on Facebook. And I think Instagram gives you just a platform to show more of your editorial in a way, or give a glimpse of the editorial, or just send out one little message. And we really, since a year, we really upped our game on Instagram and producing actually things especially for Instagram, which we would do previously for our website. So, yeah, Instagram is very important at the moment, yeah.
And one thing I was going to ask, not only Fantastic Man changed, but fashion very much, especially menswear. One thing that I always liked about Fantastic Man, there's always like a cheeky side to it, you know, there's the like a humor behind. And it's interesting because I think fashion's moved towards that. How did you sense the change in fashion since you started the magazine? Or you guys perhaps don't care so much about the trends?
Well, we never care so much about the trends. I think also things are moving in menswear on a very slow pace, especially like there's never really big shifts. It's just menswear feels more, it gets updated rather than with women's, where you know, they're real trends. And sometimes the way women dress can drastically change from one year to another. I think in the 12 years, there has been a massive change, I think, for men just in general, because I think men in general became very fuzzy about what they're wearing, what they're drinking, what they're eating, are they wearing a fragrance or not, where they're going on holidays. All these kind of things became quite an important market, I think, for a lot of brands. And a lot of brands have been experimenting with men's luxury and creating products for men on a very high level, let's say, and with a very high price. And that's maybe the biggest shift in the last couple of years, that men's luxury didn't take off the way brands thought it was going to take off. And you see right now, especially with Vêtements and how younger people, millennials, dress, that streetwear has become very, very dominant, also for luxury brands right at the moment.
You spoke about teenagers. Do you have an image of the reader of Fantastic Man, or you honestly think he can be from a teenager or a guy perhaps like Steven here on the cover?
Well, this is one of the reasons why we made this issue about age, because there's a kind of confusion almost about who is the reader. And I really believe there's not one reader, but we've grown up ourselves with the magazines, and we're right now middle-aged men. And we see young people also reading the magazine and buying it. And so we have the feeling that we need to cater for a lot of people, and a lot of people with different backgrounds, also culturally. So not only is this issue, and there are a couple of shoots that actually deal with different generations of men, we also have like a very, very broad editorial spectrum of shoots happening in different parts of Europe and the world, different ages. Very big one in Rio. We have like retired grandpas in Ireland. We have just an extremely big scope of guys, boys, and men. And yeah, there's an immense diversity in this issue, and there's a great diversity in age and race and backgrounds. And we also changed this issue a little bit is, we did less, let's say, only visual-driven stories, but a lot of like editorial-driven stories, So you feel there's just so much editorial material in there. And that's, I think, what people really appreciate about this issue. It feels like everything is talking to you and everything has a voice and an idea and an opinion and a sense of humor and a joy to it. I think that's very Fantastic Man, when things feel kind of joyful and just brings a smile to your face.
In terms of design and editorial, do you think the magazine continues with the, you know, the Dutch DNA? Of course, you and Hert are Dutch, and you know the magazine has an office there in Amsterdam as well.
Yeah, well, I'm still the head designer of the magazine, so it's still a form of Dutch design, I guess. But it's just hard to say, because the way the magazine looks these days, it's always about position, and it's always about making the words and the images speak. For me, it's more about editorial design, which has a DNA, but that Dutch DNA, I don't think is so apparent in the way it looks. It's more in the way it communicates.
What next? I mean, I was talking behind. Are you already planning the next issue? Or how does it work for a biannual title? When do you start, like, getting worried? Oh my God, we have to make sure everything's ready.
Well, you start to get worried the moment the new one comes out, basically.
Yeah.
You always feel a year too late. But, you know, it never really makes sense to start in March with an issue, with a magazine that comes out in September. So we tend to start around April and May, and then most things get commissioned, written or photographed mostly in June and July, and put together also in August, and it comes out in September.
Jop van Bennekom there from Fantastic Man, talking to you, Fernando, a little earlier. Now, Faye, no peace for the wicked. You've been out on the road, not too far, though. We're sat, of course, here in Midori House in Marylebone, and you headed earlier this week to Somerset House. Tell us a bit about what you were doing there.
A fantastic exhibition, Tom. It's called Print, Tearing It Up, Independent British Magazines Changing the World. I mean, it's a lovely magazine, seeing how some of those indie titles, I mean, in fact, Fantastic Man is included there, but also, you know, historic titles like The Face, you know, even Smash Hits or The Gentlewoman, some smaller publications. It's a beautiful, beautiful exhibition. Even on the third room, there's a little newsstand in the form of the one in Sloane Square here in London. But, you know, it's very bright pink. It's a beautiful place to go. And the curators, I spoke to the curators. Paul Gorman, which being on the show, he wrote a book about The Face magazine, and Claire Cutterell as well. Very interesting one.
For us, it's not so much that they're relevant, it's that they're really important. And especially today, I think, when the magazines that you're seeing have such force and such agency. In a way, they're building on the magazines of the past to create a completely new voice. So they're giving agency to a lot of underrepresented groups, such as the LGBTQ community, people of colour, biracial people, people from multiple cultural backgrounds. And a lot of these groups would never have seen themselves represented in print before or felt included. So we felt it was really, really important to show that. So to show really the importance of print in the power that it has to put across a message, but also the fact that a lot of these magazines are made by people who literally kind of woke up one morning and decided that, you know, they didn't find anything or they haven't seen anything for them out there and decided to make a magazine. So we wanted to say, actually, you can do it too.
And Paul, one of the fascinating things at this exhibition is that, for example, here in the first room, there's a copy of a magazine called Blast, which is from 1915, and it's together with Gauden, which is a much more recent. But to be honest, they kind of, not that they look like each other, but, you know, it's not like, oh my God, these are the old ones and the new ones. They have more or less the same role in a way. Was that your intention in this exhibition, to not make only a chronological list of magazines, but also show how, you know, their role in society as well?
I think that's correct. You know, we made a couple of decisions, one of which was that it should be non-linear or non-chronological, but also that there is an equivalence between the magazines that we like, which are being produced now independently, and those from the past. I mean, the interesting thing about Blast is that it's the full stop on Victorianism, and it's the beginning of modernism, and it is literally a modernist manifesto. And we're really, really pleased to have issue two. There are only ever two issues because World War One interrupted, and so they had other things to be doing. But we're really pleased to have an original copy of the second issue, the so-called war number. And then we juxtaposed that with a publication called Crash, which was produced by Scott King, who is the designer of the graphic identity of the exhibition. And his work is pretty well known. He's a designer and artist. And Crash was literally a response to Blast. It was the end of the century. What starts off with the Blast ends in a crash. And he railed against Blairite Britain and Brit Art and Britpop. And we thought that these were connected to such publications as Gaudem, which actually came out of the online environment first. And so we present the website for people to browse, but there's also an issue of Gaudem there, because Gaudem has that ability to disrupt and challenge just as much as Crash did in the 90s and Blast did during the First World War.
I think we should move on to the second room. Great, we're in the amazing second room, and I have to start with you, Claire. If you can explain, you know, for those who are not here at Somerset House now, there's such a beautiful mind map, quite complex, but you know, with all the magazines that are part of the exhibition, if you don't mind explaining a little bit the idea for the mind map.
Yeah, well, we thought it would be really fun to do just to show, because we can't obviously put every single magazine in the exhibition, so we wanted to try and put every single magazine on the wall and try and explain how they linked to each other and try and create clusters around particular themes so that people will be able to get a sense of how some of these magazines led to others, and there's a real kind of family tree feeling about it. I have to give credit to this map to Paul Gorman, my co-curator, because he, with his expert knowledge of magazines, was the one who tirelessly put together every single magazine title he could think of, but also Rhys Atkinson, the designer, whose task was unenviable, trying to make all this link. And it's 2D, so it's flat, but slightly frustratingly, I think a lot of the connections you can't really make on a 3D map, and in many ways it would be great if it was a globe in 3D, because I think some of the links from magazines at either end of the map, and it's difficult to try and bring everything together. So it really is a kind of absolutely extraordinary view of the culture of independent magazines in Britain. And of course we start it all off with Blast, which is right at the centre, and everything emanates out from that. We've picked out certain key magazines in bright pink, so we've got things like The Face and Private Eye, really key moments. Monocle, of course, is in there as well.
And Paul, of course, in the second room, there's a few very rare copies of The Face, and I know you're an expert on the topic as well. Can you tell us which ones and how did you get those copies as well?
They're from my collection because I wrote a book about The Face, so that was helpful. In fact, it was one of the things that fed into the show as Claire and I talked about how the show would be composed. We're really pleased that Nick Logan, the founder of The Face, loaned us this paste-up of the contents of the very first issue. And so people who don't understand how magazines were produced pre-Apple Macs can kind of gain an insight into how fiddly it was and how much care and consideration you had to put into just even building a contents page. But we've also got a classic issue from the 80s, which is the Hard Times cover, which featured a story by Robert Elms about how hard drugs and hard living was really biting into Thatcherite Britain in the early 80s. But then we contrast that with an issue from the early 90s, which showcased Kate Moss from 1991. And this really summed up the optimism that was felt in what they described as the third summer of love.
And before we go to the third and final room, which is a very beautiful, how did you divide this time the magazines here? I guess it's in topics, right? So, for example, these ones here are all about art, right? And then there's lifestyle.
We've divided them all up into kind of cultural clusters. So we've got one here that talks about art and graphic arts. So we've got magazines like Pavement Liquor, Garage Land, Freeze, of course, and then we've got selections based around lifestyle. So, of course, that includes Dazed, but also magazines like Rave and Courier. Then we're looking at sort of broader literary culture, Little White Lies, which is a magazine about films, poetry, literature, Then we look at architecture, so it's The Real Review with Blueprint and AR, really important magazines. Then music, of course, and also fashion.
And Paul, isn't it fascinating that, you know, when you look at the mainstream press, I'm not saying they're as radical as the indies, but my God, sometimes they did copy or they were very much influenced by some of the indie titles. It's fascinating. It looks like the indie titles have the upper hand this time.
Well, I think that's, you know, one of the main messages of the show is that, you know, this is really where the vanguard ideas were circulating and where primacy was given to adventurous design, graphic usage, photography, and of course journalism. And so quite often those mainstream corporate magazines co-opt the ideas from this sphere. And it's going to be interesting to see what happens to the current range of new magazines and how they fare in the next 5 years or so, which I guess is one of the questions that this exhibition leaves hanging, doesn't it?
The insights of both the writer Paul Gorman and the senior curator Claire Cattrall of Print Tearing It Up, which is on right through till the 22nd of August at Somerset House here in London. Highly recommended for our London listeners. And frankly, Fernando, if anyone's jet-setting around, stop off and check it out because it's well worth catching. If you are as intrigued by watches and timekeeping as you are by famous august buildings on the banks of the River Thames here in London, then I'm sure you're probably familiar with that great documenter of the horological world, Hodinkee magazine. It itself is a thing of beauty. And in, I think, the most recent issue, perhaps, Fernando, it includes an interview, an exclusive indeed, with Jonny Ive, of course, Apple's chief design officer. Remind us, you spoke to the editor-in-chief. What was he keen to talk about?
Well, Jonny Ive, you know, how he's expanding the brand and the attention to print as well. Because, you know, remember, this is a brand that started online. But I think Jonny Ive has a very nice idea where he wants, you know, the brand to go when it comes to print.
Well, let's hear from him now. This is Jonny Ive in conversation with Fernando a little earlier.
Hodinkee has been around for coming on 10 years. This is our 10th year, actually. Watches are really what we're primarily known for. But we saw the magazine when we launched it late last year as an opportunity to kind of expand our editorial purview and talk about some of the other things that our editors are interested in. And these include, of course, watches, but also collectible cars, architecture, travel, style, you name it.
And let's talk as well about the beginnings of Hodinkee as well. You started with online journalism. How come you guys decided to do a print edition?
Well, that's right. We started, as I mentioned, 10 years ago, our founder, Ben Clymer, actually from a cubicle at UBS when he was a little bit bored during the economic downturn of 2008. He explored his hobby of watches and he really was looking into why are these things so expensive? Why do people collect them the way that they do? We started in 2008, and we went for a good long clip doing some of the best, you know, editorial coverage on the web around the world of watches. Initially, the idea to do a print magazine came on pretty early. I think around 2013 or so, Ben and the first employee at Hodinkee, Stephen Pulverant, started talking about the idea of doing a print magazine, but they wanted to do something that was very high end, that was very well thought out, and they decided to wait until they had the right group of people and the right circumstances for the company to dive into a print publication such as Hodinkee magazine.
And I have to say, you know, usually you guys saved an excellent interview for your issue too. You know, such a scoop. We have a 16-page interview with Apple chief design officer Jonathan Ive. You know, what a scoop. What was the process to get Jonathan involved in this article?
Well, I mean, we have been covering certainly the Apple Watch launches as they've happened. And those have been some of our best performing stories on the site. People are really interested in the Apple Watch. And we became aware over time that people at Apple were reading the stories and interested in what we had to say. And so we were able to make a connection with people at Apple, including Jonny Ive. We reached out and said, you know, this is a great story that we would love to tell. We think the magazine is the correct platform to tell it. You know, Jonny is, by at least one definition, the designer of the world's top-selling watch. We flew Ben out to Cupertino along with our creative director, Jay Golian. We did a fantastic, I think, 5,000-word interview with Jonny Ive on the genesis of the Apple Watch. And as you mentioned, it was a scoop. We got some information from Jonny that I don't think has been reported anywhere else before. For example, the Apple Watch is the first or one of the first major Apple projects that started after the passing of Steve Jobs. And we also learned that Jonny had, in Apple, had assembled a crew of consultants to talk to from the world of high-end Swiss watchmaking. as they decided to get into making a watch. So they didn't just jump into it as if they were starting from scratch. They really respected the fact that they were entering a product category with hundreds of years of its own history, and they wanted to respect that.
Jonathan, I'm very curious as well, what's the business plan for Hodinkee? Because you're not like a normal mag. So, for example, if one of our listeners want to go to a newsstand, probably they can't find it. So where can they go and buy a copy of Hodinkee?
That's right. We have, I think, very good distribution through some newsstands. We have great in-room distribution at a number of hotels. And you can find us if you're looking, certainly, in different markets around the world. For most people, I think they're going to end up on Hodinkee.com. We have a pretty robust e-commerce component, the Hodinkee shop, where you can place your order for the Hodinkee magazine, among other sorts of things, such as straps, etc., for watches.
Is it mainly kind of a North American market, or do you have some international subscribers or international people that go to your site and buy the title?
People come from all over the world. I'd say at this point, it's still a majority coming from North America, but we have many, many visitors coming from Europe, especially from London, from Switzerland, from Germany, and then, of course, all around the English-speaking world. So Australia, South Africa, you name it, people are going to Hodinkee and reading.
I would like to ask a question about watches, because it's quite interesting. It's a very important sector, especially for print media. You know, I think a lot of kind of magazines and even newspaper supplements have kind of watches special. So what do you do to be different from those kind of, or perhaps, you know, not that different, perhaps maybe there's one supplement that you admire as well?
I think the New York Times has done a great job with their watch supplements. I think the Wall Street Journal also has a very good watch coverage. But I think what really sets Hodinkee apart is that we write for collectors. We write for people who are interested in watches that extend beyond just what happened to be the next big new release at SIHH or Baselworld. We certainly cover those things in a big way. Baselworld is like our Super Bowl, but we also cover the auctions in a big way. And we're very interested to know what's happening with the secondary market. So, and also, you know, whenever we write a story talking about a specific watch that people might be interested in collecting, we're always looking for that little nugget that you might not be able to find elsewhere. One example of that from the magazine that I could talk about would be this wonderful article, actually the second article that Ben wrote in volume 2 about collecting waterproof Universal Genève chronographs. And if you read that article, you'll find out that he is able to discover along his collecting journey that this very wonderful company, Spillman, out of Le Chaux-de-Fonds, Switzerland, was making cases for Universal Genève. And they were also making cases for the Rolex, for a certain very collectible reference of the Rolex Daytona. And Ben is able to conclude that the kind of just the wearability and the wonderfulness of this watch and why he loves it so much probably comes down to the fact that Spillman was making the cases way back in the early 60s. And so that's something that probably had never been reported elsewhere that collectors would love to know and that Hodinkee is in a position to get out there and cover.
The insights of John Buse from Hodinkee magazine, talking, Fernando, with you a little earlier. Really interesting selection of chats across a whole raft of the independent publishing scene. And Faye, we should say not only thanks to you for producing the programme, thanks to our editors Cathy Galpin and Sarah Miles as well. Our listeners over the next couple of weeks might be hearing a bit more from you even than normal. You might be in the chair hosting the Stack for a couple of weeks, perhaps.
Just for a couple of weeks, you know, you have a well-deserved holiday, Tom.
Faye means that euphemistically. I will be quite tired as my parenting duties increase by 100%. But lots of exciting stuff ahead in the weeks to come, so our listeners must watch this space.
Absolutely.
Indeed, you must. If you want to get in touch with Fernando directly, Faye, you're always happy, aren't you, for people to reach out?
Please, fp at monocle.com.
There you go. That's the email. Drop Fernando a note and do be sure to join him, most likely, at the same time next week for more from The Stack. But for this week, and from me, Tom Edwards, that's all we have time for. Thanks for tuning in.